thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and information source. Today's special guest, Dr. Chris Martinson from Peak Prosperity. Welcome back, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
You know, I thought we could start off today with the NASDAQ. In recent weeks, within striking distance of that 2000 high point, the Dow Jones regularly posting 117-year record highs, the highest point in its history. And a general consensus on the street seems to be, well, blue skies abound, the domestic economy is in full recovery mode. Nevertheless, your work seems to be less sanguine regarding the prospects of the market and the economy. You seem less convinced that the Fed has sidestepped economic volatility. How come?
Well, not only have they not sidestepped volatility, which seems to be back in vogue here in 2015, but what the Fed can't do, hasn't done, will never be able to do, is print prosperity. They've printed up a lot of money. It's flowed predictably into financial assets, everything, stocks you mentioned, but look at the price of junk bonds, my goodness, or Italian 10-year debt at, 1%. It's never before seen in the history of data series to go back hundreds of years. Have we seen interest rates this low, negative interest rates are a brand new condition? All of this, Chris, is just a side effect of printing a lot of money and shoving it into the financial markets. We haven't seen a whole lot of capital expenditures by corporations. People talk about how corporations have a lot of cash on the balance sheet. What they're not looking at is the debt that they've taken on their balance sheets as well. Those offset to a large extent. Global growth is predictably low and slow. And I say predictably because this was always the consequence of too much debt. This is what every nation has gotten into too much debt has found itself saddled with. That's the bottom line problem that we have. The Fed is blissfully, delightfully unaware of the role of debt because they don't study it because they don't think it's important.
Debt, it seems to be our friend, at least on paper. It allows us to buy maybe houses, sometimes beyond our means, cars, activities that seem to increase and enhance our productivity and thus push the economy. However, there are times when debt just seems to be destructive. Do you see something like that on the horizon?
Well, I do, because you mentioned the two types of debt that are out there. I call them good and bad debt. Good debt is debt that you take on to increase your productivity. You're going to invest in property, plant, and equipment. You're going to expand your manufacturing processes. You're going to, in other words, borrow money to make money. That's okay. But when you're borrowing money just to spend money, which is what a car is, which is what a house is, most people unfortunately think of a house as an asset. It's a liability. It's a cash cow. It costs you money every month. That's a liability. We're using a lot of our debt to just foster consumption. Government debt fostering just consumption, whether we're spending it on wars or just siphoning it through into the entitlement programs and paying it off into a bloated healthcare system. However we're doing that, the government is not investing, corporations aren't investing. And so that's really why when I look at the future, you always want to say, what's going to be the engine of growth going forward? And I don't see that technology, I don't see that new direction that we can go into really on the horizon at this point in time. Most corporations are just sitting down waiting for things to get even better and not really investing in the future.
Well, they also have the enviable option to use debt, I think, in more constructive ways because they have access to virtually free money, as we've learned over the past few years. Good luck for the rest of us. For the most part, I see so many of these corporations buying back, as you know, their own capital stock. This has a positive short-term impact on the markets. One topic that you brought up that I think is so pertinent, this idea of just how important a mortgage is to get ahead. When we take a look at Dr. Shiller's work at Yale, Case Shiller Index fame, he's done quite an interesting study you've probably seen going back roughly 118, 120 years, and it shows that really housing, for the most part, didn't even keep up with inflation. In fact, the typical house would yield maybe 1% a year, and that's assuming you don't have all those related expenses that you pointed to. And when you look at housing, I'm going to place a, here, I'm putting a bullseye on my back right here for now. nasty grams for some of our realtor and real estate listeners, but we need to look at housing more objectively. This is not necessarily a bona fide asset. It is really a mixed asset that has all these hidden liabilities that have been conveniently tucked away. There are millions of people who have just been disappointed by housing that were foreclosed on, over 10 million people over the last 5-6 years. Once again, they're getting that nudge and push by relatives and friends and other folks in the industry. It's time to buy. It's time to buy. Why might that not be the case?
Well, it's not the case in a lot of areas of this country. Unfortunately, we're going to see some really nasty surprises to the downside for whole regions. And I know that, Chris, simply because, you know, houses are just a place to live that cost you money. And so if there's a time when, you know, just purely financially, you have to make a decision, should I rent or should I own? Well, if the cost to own is more than the cost to rent, financially it makes sense to keep renting, right? Well, we look at places like the whole Silicon Valley in California where average house prices are over $1 million. And that is so far in excess of what the average income is that we know that only one of two things is going to happen. Either incomes are going to shoot to the moon or house prices are going to crash back to earth. Those are the only options. We see the same housing bubble dynamics across Australia, all over Canada, most major metropolitan areas. And so people get confused because they see prices going up and they think, oh, this is an asset. Assets go up in price. But a house is not an asset that generates any form of return for you. It doesn't pay a dividend. It doesn't have a interest-bearing coupon. And so the price of houses has been heavily inflated by Fed policies, two policies. One, just dumping money into the world, and that just inflates the prices of all kinds of things. And the second is they've driven interest rates to all-time record lows for mortgages. And so the amount a house is quote-unquote worth, how much somebody will pay for it, and the rate of interest they have to pay on the mortgage, those are connected events. Rule of thumb, every time mortgage rates go up by 1%, the price that a house a person can afford goes down by 10%. So there's been a lot of froth and fluff put into this. And I got to tell you, it's a generational issue because the young people who want to buy a first house do not appreciate the Fed having propped up the prices of houses because they can't afford them. The older people, they love it. Hey, you know, the Fed helped me out, lifted the value of my house, allegedly. But what we're starting to see more and more is the young people, the millennials, are choosing not to buy houses. They're choosing not to accumulate possessions beyond what they need. Many of them are choosing not to drive. They're using Uber instead. And so what we're finding is that the Fed has basically forced a whole generation into a new way of being. Here's a tip. In about 5 or 10 years, when these 10,000 boomers a day who are retiring want to put 10,000 big homes on the market, there won't be anybody there to buy them.
You talk about what happens when rates increase. We have all these central bankers colluding around the world, holding rates in negative territory. I want to address just what happens when rates increase, because eventually they must. It may be either at the central banker's command, or it might be just market forces, but eventually they will rise. Home prices traditionally don't do too well under that environment because we've had rates at historically low levels for so long, and that would seem to imply that you could lock in a ridiculously low interest rate right now on a 15 or even 30 year. But in some ways, it's almost like buying a bond. Sure, you're locking in a decent rate right now, but what's going to happen to your principal, which is inversely related to interest rates, should this Titanic turn around on you? That's where we could see folks not necessarily facing a 2007-2008 style collapse, but a long, lingering Tokyo style housing market for a generation or two. What do you think?
Well, that's always possible. You know, if you can lock in a 30-year mortgage at today's interest rates, I think that would be a great idea if that's what you're going to do. But to lock that in and overpay today with the expectation that you're going to be able to sell that house to somebody else for more money in the future, I don't think that's a good guess at this point in time. That's not a good bet because When interest rates are at all-time record lows, the odds are they're going to go up at some point, not down. That's just playing the odds. Now, a lot of people have convinced themselves, look, the Fed, and I think this is a good line of thinking, so let's talk about it, have said to themselves, look, the Fed's got themselves boxed into a corner. They can't raise rates because if they do, they'll destroy the treasury market, they'll destroy their own balance sheet, they'll destroy the country. So they can't. Well, this is really, I think right as far as it goes on the surface, but as you hinted before, and something I believe to be true, is that the market ultimately ends up setting rates of interest, and the Fed has to follow along. Yeah, they can really manipulate the trend for a while, and they have, but that's as long as nothing's going wrong or, you know, all the world banks are colluding. We're looking at, you know, the possibility here that the world central banks are going to have to start to play in ways that benefit their own populations, not what benefits, you know, the United States' specific housing situation. And so I'm looking for both volatility as a return in this 2015 year, and sometime this year, maybe next year, we're going to see the fracturing, the splintering of central bank collusion. We're going to start to see them really begin to have to figure out how they're going to operate all on their own. And we're seeing early signs of that.
And as we wrap up this thought on housing and move into the FOMC and related rates, potential increases there and recent FOMC meetings, you know, I'd just like to give two rules of thumb, okay, for listeners. Firstly, you're being pushed into a $150,000 mortgage. Maybe it's a discount at half price of where these houses were 8 years ago. That 30-year mortgage is going to cost you at least $300,000. So by the time, you know, you're ready to retire or nearing retirement, your kids are out of the home and in college, you will have paid $300,000, even at current prices, to pay off that $150,000 home. I think this is something that very few people even start to think about, not to mention the 1% minimum that you're going to have in upkeep each year, $1,500 additional dollars that you won't see in any mortgage calculators, not any I've seen, because it's, again, one of those hidden shadow expenses that folks just don't want to talk about. Also, I would throw out here on a more positive note, if you are going to purchase a home, think about the rule of thumb of 100. And that is if the typical rental price in your area is $1,000, okay, multiply that per month, that is, multiply that by 100, and you get a ballpark idea of what a similar home should be selling for. So $1,000 a month times 100, $100,000. So you really want to work with that. And if you live in Silicon Valley, as Dr. Martinson pointed out, or New York, Manhattan, okay, you're going to have to that appropriately. You're talking about beachfront property. That's a completely different scenario. Back to this FOMC meeting. Fed governors, they're backpedaling somewhat in their latest rate hike plans, swinging between patient and impatient. Clearly, they're perturbed by this looming threat of a Greek exit from the EU and resulting currency volatility. It sent the US dollar soaring to a 12-year high and, you know, just a few months' time, and the euro plunging. Please do your best to support or refute the case for benchmark lending rate increase by summer of 2015.
Well, I don't think the Fed's going to do it, because the Fed is at this point making and forming their policy around what the Dow Jones did that morning. They've locked themselves into a day trading mentality. They're following the markets tick by tick. We've seen them every time the market has a slight bit of weakness, they trot out another Fed official to amend or modify the previous statements to suggest maybe they're going to be more dovish in going forward. So I think they're really locked into a horrible mentality, which is they are now slaves to this Franken market that they've created. And the problem, as we've seen, is the market's bumped its head three times now against a mark here, call it 18,000 and change for the Dow, 2,100 for the S&P, and is unable to sort of get past that point. I don't think the Fed's going to raise rates at all until, you know, they feel they can. I don't think they can at this point. And let's be clear, too. When we say raise rates, they're going to telegraph it many, many, many months in advance, and it's going to be something totally meaningless, like a quarter of a point, you know, a quarter of a percent.
The U.S. dollar is already priced in a small token increase at this point.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think it'll have any particular impact once it comes, because it'll be priced in many months in advance.
Moving on to geopolitical hotspots, you know, it remains pretty troubling. Tensions in the Middle East, the Ukraine continue to ratchet up. Let's begin with your view, your vantage point on the Middle East. Israel and Iran are at loggerheads. We see the threat of a viable nuclear weapon on the horizon. Given the latest, you know, election there with Benjamin Netanyahu again gaining the reins of Israel and his viewpoint on Iraq, which is opposite of that from Washington, do you expect further tactical strikes or perhaps even a full-scale conflict on the horizon?
Well, there's so many cross currents on that, you hardly know what to believe. So obviously the Obama administration is attempting to strike some sort of a deal with Iran. We think that's in everybody's interest, not least of which is Iran has the last best great untapped oil reserves that we know about on the planet. That would be a great place to open up business for Western oil companies to get in there. We know that they're saying, let's get this deal done, because they would love to get in there. On the other side, you know, the United States keeps selling advanced military hardware and bunker busters to Israel. You know, remember, it was just a couple years ago, we sold them 5,000 bunker busters. You know, you don't need bunker busters to bomb Gaza. You need those for some other mission, right? So we seem to be playing both sides of this one. It's very hard to figure out what's actually happening.
Okay, moving on to the inflation-deflation debate. The inflation camp seemed to have it right almost 12 years consecutively, with gold soaring from its low of around $260 or so, maybe a bit higher, all the way up to nearly $2,000. But you are looking for more deflation, and with the dollar regularly hitting new highs, it certainly seemed to be the correct viewpoint. Give us an idea on how you expect for the precious metals to behave under such a scenario.
All right. Well, first, a quick definition. You know, in the media, they always say that inflation, we know it's there because we have rising prices. Deflation is there because we have falling prices. Both are incorrect. Inflation means money and credit are expanding above a certain level. Deflation means money and credit are falling. And by the way, whenever in all of the United States history, whenever credit growth has sunk under 2% per year, we've been in recession. So we clearly are a credit-driven economy, and you have to watch that very carefully. What I'm seeing across the world right now is really supporting the idea of being in a deflationary environment. Credit growth is very low. People are generally not borrowing all that much. The ones who are borrowing, like corporations, are really just using that borrowing for financial purposes, as we discussed, you know, to buy their own shares back or things like that. Makes perfect financial sense, just doesn't drive growth. When we look at the signs, you know, the symptoms of inflation deflation, the big things that I track, oil, coal, steel, cement, those are the basic components of economic expansion. All of those are in deep bear markets and just falling in price. Tells me that we have weak economic expansion. That dovetails very nicely with the observation that we're seeing very, very weak credit growth. So overall, the world is not in a growth environment right now, and this is the thing that the central bankers fear the most. Let's be clear, they don't care if your milk costs more or less next month. That doesn't bother them in the slightest. When they say they're worried about deflation, what they're worried about is that new credit growth will not be sufficient to allow sufficient flows of money through the banking system to pay off the old loans that were issued last year. So we under deflation, the banking system gets hit, the whole financial system threatens to collapse. It's a really dire situation, has nothing to do with prices, although they talk about it. That's what the central banks really care about. I'm seeing that we are close to that tipping point again, just like in 2008, where we're seeing really, really pathetic credit growth of a level that's low enough to really cause some concern.
Exactly. And I like your idea there that the powers that be aren't terribly concerned by the prices that we pay at the grocery store. I mean, after all, as they say on the street, they've got your back because we have EBT debit cards, i.e. food stamps. And of course, they can be increased to whatever level our officials require in order to keep the masses content. Well, give us an idea, though, how we should be positioning our portfolio, the equities component, even bond component of a balanced, diversified portfolio has fared well in the past few years. Precious metals over the last 15 years have done quite well, but in the last 3 years, not so great. Now, is that presenting an opportunity for maybe repositioning some of our assets?
Well, absolutely. I'm a huge fan of the idea that one should always have a core component in gold. And the reason for that is not because of inflation. It's actually deflation that is the reason I want to own gold in this story. And that's because under deflation, we're going to see ruined countries and destroyed banks. And when we had our deflation in 2008, the paper price of gold went down for a little bit, but then, of course, went much higher. And the reason for that is that gold is a tier one asset. It's truly the only financial asset you can own that is not somebody else's liability. And in a time of crisis, the thing that gets hurt the most is interagency trust. So Bank A does not trust Bank B because they don't know if Bank B's, you know, going belly up or solvent or what. Nobody knows in a crisis. Deflation equals crisis. Crisis equals rising gold prices. That's part one that I like it. But part two is just where we are in this larger story with the flow of gold into China consuming more than 100% of world mine output at this point, India consuming half again as much. It's just astonishing. So gold flows from west to east at this point in time. And then just yesterday, even Goldman Sachs finally noticed, hey, if you look at all the world gold mines, they actually are exhausted within the next 20 years, and then there's no more coming out of the ground. What do we do with that information? Well, to me, this is an extraordinary time to be alive. Listen, there's no shortage of paper money. The Fed can print as much as it wants. Will it print more? Probably. Could I make an argument to buy equities because the Fed will always prop them up? Probably. But you're playing a game. The thing that I'm more certain about, Chris, is that the resources of the world are being stripped down to the last nuggets to coming out of the ground, the last awful ore grades. And that within the next 20 years, people are going to wake up and go, hey, they really aren't making any more of this stuff anymore. Well, how much can I possibly own? And on that basis, on a fundamental basis, both for the flows currently going from west to east, plus what's not going to be coming out of the ground in not that many years.
Well, just to underscore and embolden these thoughts you've laid out, firstly, you talk about transparency between Company A and Company B and the potential for lack of trust there. Circa 2007, 2008, there was very little time to prepare. These events unfold at a lightning strike pace today relative to, let's say, 1970s, 75. I mean, you had plenty of time to buy gold and silver for the most part at that time. Today, with the ubiquitous nature of the internet and transportation, not to mention availability, the lack of constraints placed on folks such as China, there is a limited supply and the potential for enormous demand. Is that a good recipe for higher prices and inelastic demand as well? I think it just makes a great case for that diversification.
If I can circle back to the other side of the world quickly, is in Ukraine. I know it's out of our news cycle, but it's certainly still a very hot situation over there. Russia is still constantly grumbling about how unhappy it is with the United States, and people should know it was just announced yesterday that the United States is going to be putting some members of, I believe, the 173rd Air Wing paratroopers are going in for training exercises in Ukraine in April. For the life of me, why the United States feels it has to both put armaments all along Russia's border and then slip in a few hundred troops for quote unquote training exercises into Ukraine. That's interesting. And the most interesting part is they're going to be training with a battalion of Ukrainian troops, if I could use that term loosely. This is one of the most hardcore, how do we put this? Ultra-nationalist would be the kindest word. These are base troops, and the United States is going in and performing training exercises with this specific battalion. It's really quite a bit of a slap in the face. So the United States is still doing what it's doing in terms of poking Russia, but I think in terms of world opinion, by the way, the name of that battalion is the Azov, A-Z-O-V, the Azov Battalion. Why we're specifically choosing that one, what would we call this? Active diplomacy.
It's like the circus trainer who maybe had one too many last night and is prodding the bear in the cage. It doesn't seem like a wise strategy for a nation facing its own troubles and geopolitical uncertainty. Maybe you would like to give folks an idea of what this potentially means for their portfolios.
The risk here is that the United States pokes the bear one too many times. Something happens. We've discussed this before where, you know, when you line up a bunch of military hotheads near each other, sometimes accidents happen or sometimes something deliberate happens. But it seems like the United States wants additional confrontation with Russia for reasons that frankly elude me, but I'm sure somebody has some good ones somewhere. And so there's a larger game playing out here. If or when this does break out into larger hostilities, what we're going to discover is that the world is going to get plunged into crisis very quickly, mostly because of skyrocketing energy prices. I know that seems unthinkable here at $50 a barrel oil, but trust me, if we got into any sort of a hotter conflict, either in the Middle East or with Russia, we could easily see oil double, triple, quadruple in price from here, creating a shock to the system. Under such a shock scenario, I would not want to be holding paper assets to any extent, or I'd just want to be mentally prepared to have those lose a lot of value very quickly. Because as you mentioned, the whole world is interconnected. When things unfold, they do it rapidly. Financial markets are capable of both erupting and then being closed in a fraction of a second now. So we're looking for, you know, highly increased volatility if hostilities get further out. And if things do go hot with Russia, I will tell you the United States is going to be extremely disappointed with the outcome, because we're going to discover that our powerful Navy is not worth a lot when it's up against a modern foe. Some very, very troubling incidents happened so far, one couple years back, one this year, that prove just how formidable Russia can be.
Firstly, on the one hand, you say, well, you know, oil presenting an incredible opportunity, and clearly, given the decline of 50% or more in the past few months as the dollar soared, it would seem to be presenting a remarkable opportunity for many investors. However, on the other hand, you worry a bit about that deflationary scenario, as well as paper asset concerns.
Yeah, for those who are sophisticated enough, futures work reasonably well. The carrying cost is low, and you can roll them over, and that's one way. Options are possible, but those are trickier.
Especially on that USO ETF, the crude oil, West Texas Intermediate Crude ETF, has a tendency not to walk in a lockstep with the underlying contract. It makes me very nervous looking at it over the long term. So I think that's good advice for folks.
Yeah, no, that's a bad contract. It's a bad ETF the way it's designed, because what they have to do is they have to roll over a whole boatload of contracts as they're going from one month to the next. And every trader in the world knows that, and they get front run, and they lose a couple of percent on that just because of how it's constructed. They're losing to front runners on a consistent monthly basis. It's a very high tax on the performance of that ETF. They know about it. There's not a lot they can do. So that's not a great vehicle. I do think that the time will come to reinvest in the U.S. shale operators. I think that there's a winnowing process has to happen. There's a bunch of companies there that don't make any sense. They're going to have to get their assets written down and their liabilities written down. They'll get acquired. But what I love about the shale plays as we go forward is they become the swing producer. You know, you can basically decide to drill a well and have that thing flowing in about 3 months. And that means that, you know, it's not like when you want to do a Gulf of Mexico deal, which it might be 10 years from the idea to the first barrel flowing. Now that we understand the shale geology, anytime we want, we can just start punking a whole bunch of holes into the ground and get more flow out. So I think they'll be very responsive to swings in prices. But right now, let's be clear, the price of oil today is about half what is necessary to support additional exploration and discovery and production processes. So it's not happening, which means that in a couple of years from now, if oil stays low, we run into huge supply problems. So I know that well before we run into giant supply problems, price will respond. It has to go up, but could go lower from here. And the main thing that concerns me is that if we do strike a deal with Iran has 20 million barrels of oil floating off of its shores right now, stored in giant crude carriers, just waiting to hit market. If they, anytime they want, they can put an extra 20 million barrels into the world market. And, you know, when we're oversupplied by about 1 million barrels a day, that could be quite a shock to the system.
Another caveat, if you take a look at the rig situation, the active oil rigs, particularly in the Midwest over the past few years during the fracking bonanza there, all throughout the heartland. And of course, that has just literally imploded, but is still at remarkably high levels. There does seem to be the potential to decline. That whole region is suffering and will continue to suffer all the way from Houston to North Dakota. There is a massive glut domestically of oil. There's a whole industry that I think requires some major adjustments. Does that mean that oil won't present great opportunity in the months going forward? No way. I'm completely on board with you. Let folks know more about the services you provide and your websites, please.
Well, certainly, if people want to follow things in sort of the vein that you and I have been discussing, we do that on a daily basis at peakprosperity.com. We have a lot of free information there. We have a subscription newsletter service as well for people who like to go deeper. And what we're doing over there is we are understanding the reality of the world we live in, both economically and on the energy side, also with the environment. When you put all three things together, it basically says, look, folks, it's really time to begin preparing. If you're waiting for the government to tell you it's time to prepare, it's too late. So we're all about taking responsibility for our own lives and making our own lives happier, healthier, wealthier.
Very good. And if you wouldn't mind sharing the web address, please.
Peakprosperity.com, P-E-A-K, prosperity, P-R-O-S-P-E-R. ITY.
Very good. And precious metals friendly, looking to potential deflation, which you expect to be a positive for the yellow metal on a forward basis.
Correct.
Dr. Martinson, we really appreciate you and look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Thank you much.